Welcome to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. It's almost impossible to turn on the TV or radio, read the paper, look at your newsfeed on your smartphone, and not see a story about the recent executive order on immigration. Signed by President Donald Trump last month, it temporarily halts the admittance of refugees into the U.S. and prevents immigrants from seven predominantly Muslim countries from coming here. However, enforcement of the order is on hold. Just days after its signing, a judge ruled the ban unconstitutional and granted a restraining order, so it couldn't be enforced. The Department of Justice appealed that decision, and a three-judge panel on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals heard oral arguments Tuesday about reinstating the ban. As of Thursday morning, the court has not yet issued a ruling. North Carolina Attorney General Josh Stein recently joined at least 16 other states in opposing the immigration order. If the lower court ruling is upheld, the Justice Department, according to the Los Angeles Times, is expected to appeal to the full court or the Supreme Court of the United States. And as the world awaits that ruling, we're going to find out what the executive order could mean for people in southeastern North Carolina. With us today, Helen Terakich. She is the manager and owner of Helen Terakich Law, PLLC, specializing in immigration and naturalization cases. Helen Terakich, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you so much for having me here today.
Jeff Wittison is an attorney with McKinney Immigration Law in Wilmington, North Carolina. Jeff Wittison, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Rachel.
And joining us from the studios of Duke University is David Schanzer, professor of public policy at the Sanford School at Duke. He is also the director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security. David Schanzer, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Rachel.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. If you have a question about how this executive order affects people in North Carolina, or you think it's a necessary move that protects the American people, give us a call on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. First of all, Helen Terakich, explain what this travel ban, if it is upheld by the court, what it means for people here. Who does it affect?
So the travel ban is in place against seven Muslim majority countries. And if the court decides that the ban is constitutional and will be upheld, then those individuals will not be able to enter the United States under a variety of circumstances. So
which individuals?
That's a great question. So overall, the program for Syria has been canceled in terms of bringing refugees over. There's also a 120-day moratorium on the refugee resettlement program as a whole. And then it also limits the number of refugees for the fiscal year of 2017 to no more than 50,000. And that, I believe, that limit has either been met or will be met shortly. And then it also prohibits the immigrant and then temporary visa holders' entries into the United States from the seven countries.
Jeff Wittison, do you have clients this is affecting?
Yes, I do. I actually have two. One who's a permanent resident. Our law firm has represented in the past, who traveled abroad to visit his parents in Iran when the ban when the executive order was issued.
Overseas when this was signed.
Yes, and initially this affected people, even those who already were permanent residents, which President Trump's administration has since changed their mind on I think a number of occasions on how they treat those people who are permanent residents who are traveling outside the United States. He's scheduled to return today around 5:00 p.m. Thankfully, the temporary restraining order is in place, so halting the travel ban, we hope that he will return without any incident.
You say you hope. Is that an open question at this point?
Oh, absolutely. I don't have personal experience or witness of seeing this, but I've heard through other attorneys that there are people who are still being detained at airports and being vetted. And I mean, if you want to go to the extreme end, I've heard that the customs officers are looking on their phones to see if they have any negative things to say against President Trump, and screening them in that sense. Now that is definitely through the grapevine. So that's definitely I don't think it has actually.
That's been an allegation at this point. Yes, we don't know if that's actually true.
Yes, but in his executive order, President Trump wants to institute a test on people from these countries. Essentially, that's the whole idea of this executive order, is that he wants to do this extreme vetting, and that's part of the extreme vetting, and he hasn't defined what that is. And could that be something so, I think, intense as to give your full loyalty not just to the United States, but to the President of the United States, which I think is a very scary thought.
David Shanzer, professor at Duke University, director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security. Doesn't this executive order make us safer until we know that there's a thorough vetting process in place?
Well, the first point is that there is a very thorough vetting process in place. And I think it's also worth, for the listeners, trying to distinguish between our lingo, between refugees and immigrants. Refugees are people who are escaping the ravages of war. Their vetting process usually takes between 18 and 24 months. The United Nations and other organizations put people on a qualification list, so they do vetting already. And then our agencies, Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, does everything they can to look into their backgrounds. And we reject 90% of the people that the United Nations puts on the list. Only about 10% actually make it through our vetting process currently. And since 9/11, we don't have an instance of any refugees engaging in, from the seven countries. We don't have any examples of people who have committed violence in the U.S. So our immigration system, which are people like businessmen or business people, students, people coming to visit relatives, those are immigrants, people from those seven countries. As I said, we haven't had a single instance of terrorist-related murder in the United States ever from people from those seven countries.
And you just answered a question. The Sheila Brothers tweeted, have we had any terror attacks by people of those seven countries? You said that we have not.
Jokar. No, we haven't had any from Syrian refugees either. The one refugee example that comes to mind is the Boston Marathon bombing, which had, now they came as young boys. They weren't radicalized when they were 10 or 11 or 12. It was their experiences living here in the U.S. Where they became hostile, radicalized, engaged in the bombing. So their parents, the ones who would have been so-called vetted, the kids don't get vetted. The parents, the ones who got vetted, they didn't engage in violence at all. So
your point is, in that case, that there's nothing we could have done to prevent the kids from being here.
Yeah, somebody, for example, let's say the extreme vetting happens and people pass through it, they're going to bring their kids with them, and if they radicalize later on, I mean, that's because of what's happened here in the U.S., and therefore we should be focusing our efforts on trying to prevent radicalization here in the United States among these populations. It's not as much of a problem of our refugee and immigration system. Indeed, the vast number of violence that we've seen, which has not really been all that great, and we can talk about that later, but over the past 15 years relating to terrorism, it's almost all from homegrown terrorism. It's not from people coming into this country from abroad.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about President Trump's executive order on immigration, which temporarily stops travel for U.S. citizens from 7 Muslim-majority countries. And as we talked about this before the show started, I'm not even sure I have that right at this point. Helen Terrakeet, Jeff Whittison, we did sort of an overview of who this affects. But to be clear, are there any U.S. citizens who are being affected? Jeff Whittison, you said that you have a U.S. citizen who is living here. He's from Sudan. His wife is in Sudan.
No, he's he is originally from Sudan, but he's a U.S. citizen, naturalized. And he married a woman in Sudan. Over 2 years ago, we started the process.
She's been in Sudan.
She has been
in Sudan. It's not that she traveled back there and got trapped.
No, she's never been to the United States.
So that's a little more complicated, and she's going through a process.
She had her immigrant visa interview about 8 months ago. If you're not from a South American or Central American country, after your immigrant visa interview, you're in the United States a few weeks later. So 8 months have passed, and whenever we check in on the status, they just say security background checks is the reason why it's delayed. We've gotten both North Carolina senators asking for liaison help, and it just does not help. So there's already a vetting process that was very lengthy, and now we have this 90-day ban, and this poor guy, his wife is in a very dangerous part of the world with their child.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. It's an exploration of the local impacts of the presidential executive order on immigration. We have two local immigration attorneys with us today and the director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security, and they're taking your questions on this Thursday. The phone lines are open. You can give us a call at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. And when we come back, we'll hear from Tim. You're listening to Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. We're learning today about the local effects of the recently signed executive order on immigration, which temporarily stops non-U.S. citizens from 7 mostly Muslim countries from coming to the U.S. With us to answer your questions on this Thursday are David Schanzer, Duke Professor and Director of the Triangle Center for Terrorism and Homeland Security. We also have local immigration attorneys Helen Terrakeet and Jeff Whittison. If you have a question for our guests, you can reach us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Kim from Leland, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I have a question, and it concerns my daughter-in-law. She is a citizen of Iran. She left Iran and went to the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada, and she got her doctorate in chemistry. My son went to the University of British Columbia, and he also got his master's. Since then, my son, he just left in August, and he went to Princeton, and he's getting his doctorate in chemistry. His wife, they married in August, his wife just got a position at Albert Einstein, and she's going to get her postdoc in chemistry. Now, a couple of weeks ago, she got her application approved. But then the ban came through, and her interview was canceled. Now, since then, she is scheduled for an interview tomorrow. So I'm just kind of wondering, is there a chance, or how much of a chance is it, that this interview could be canceled and she'll have to go wait again?
Helen Terrakeet.
That's a great question, and I'm so sorry that this is happening to your family at this time. It sounds like they're just incredibly accomplished individuals. I think that what will happen at the interview tomorrow, unless there's been a decision from the Ninth Circuit that changes the decision from the Washington court, the visa processing should go as expected. I do expect that the local that the consulates in every country are going to be looking more and more closely at visa applications from anyone from the seven majority Muslim countries, which are include Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen. So if there's any irregularity in the paperwork, I would just encourage them to make sure that they go through their application with their lawyer very carefully to make sure that those irregularities could be resolved, you know, by tomorrow. Also, even though the travel ban is on a temporary restraining order at this time, it's possible that there may be additional security clearances that they want to run. They could be looking through just ordinary background checks that might take a little bit longer since we're sort of seeing a balloon now that there was travel on hold. All these other applications now have to take place again, and so there's just delays in these offices that could be expected. But I do hope that we will receive a good decision from the Ninth Circuit upholding the temporary restraining order on the ban and that your daughter-in-law will be issued her visa so that she can come to the United States and continue her program. And I just wish you all the best.
Kim, thank you.
Thank you so
much.
Can I
make a broader point?
Thank you.
Do you think, what about her chances of this interview tomorrow being canceled?
Great question. I don't think that they, you know, as long as she's got an appointment confirmation, I don't think they should be canceling that interview. I think that they're supposed to be proceeding normally under the current orders that everybody's under. The only reason that something like that would be canceled would be sometimes it's just a calendaring issue. So there are every now and then incidental cancellations unrelated to what's going on with this executive order. Or if the Ninth Circuit makes a decision today that could impact the visa interview tomorrow. So if they lift the temporary restraining order, then I wouldn't be surprised if with no notice that interview does get canceled. So I think we all just have to hope that things will continue. And I think that the travel ban, temporary restraining order was very well placed. And having listened to the oral arguments in the Ninth Circuit, you know, it's always hard to tell what a judge will do simply by listening to the oral arguments. But I did feel like the standard that they would have to meet in order to stop the temporary restraining order is so much higher that it's likely that the temporary restraining order will be upheld.
Kim, thank you so much for that phone call. David Shanzer of Duke University, you wanted to weigh in.
Yes, I want to make the point that, because you asked me before, you know, does this make us less safe? And you just heard the tremendous credentials of Kim's family. And, you know, part of our power as a nation comes from our dynamic economy, the fact that people want to come over here from all over the world to study, that our university system is the envy of the world. And that has a lot to do with our power as a nation. And when we are essentially pulling ourselves back from the world and saying to a whole host of people, well, you're not welcome here, despite the fact that you have degrees in chemistry and you're going to be a tremendous a boom to our economy, you know, that can actually weaken us as a nation. So, you know, yes, we sit here and the president keeps saying, well, one person might slip in that could do some violence. I mean, that's a risk. That's true. But in this whole conversation, we have to look at the costs. And I think when you weigh them up, the costs far, far outweigh any security benefits.
You talked, David Shanzer, about people from all over the world strengthening this country. Is it possible that times have changed enough and we've reached a new order with the proliferation of terrorism around the globe that we have to rethink and withdraw until we've figured out how to exist within this new order? Is that possible? I mean, are these fears of terrorism something to just be pushed aside as xenophobia?
No, absolutely not. People should certainly look at this issue of terrorism and take it seriously. But what they should do is assess how we have done over the past 15 years, not by, you know, the rhetoric that we hear, unfortunately, from our current president, but rather at the facts that we've been incredibly successful.
But that's history, though.
We should tighten... the history?
That's history. And going forward, I mean, what we see in the news, international headlines, terror attacks in France and Germany and Australia, and what do we make of that? I mean, that's what's happening now. Is it moving to our shores? Are we more vulnerable than we were?
No. I would say that, you know, we have been extremely successful. You know, 9/11 happened. It was 15 and a half years ago. We've done a lot in our system. We've invested billions of dollars. We do, is our systems totally perfect? No. But let me make this point. The whole idea of terrorism is that small, not very powerful organizations can't put a dent in our greatness as a nation, our ultimate security. We are a very secure nation. But through their violence, they create fear, and then it's the backlash. It is what the government does to ourself that can actually weaken us as a nation. The terrorist organizations are not powerful enough to do that on their own. But if we allow ourselves to be motivated by fear and do things and to change our fundamental system that has been so successful in building up this great nation, that is when terrorism can really hurt us.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about President Trump's executive order on immigration. Our guest today, David Shanzer, professor of public policy at the Sanford School at Duke University. He's also the director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security. Jeff Whittison, attorney at McKinney Immigration Law, and Helen Terokeach, owner and manager of Helen Terokeach Law, specializing in immigration and naturalization cases. And they're answering your questions on this Thursday. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. We have an email from Tim who writes, "While I do think the president has the legal authority to take extraordinary measures in the cause of national security, we should have learned by now that such measures should have a high bar set to leap. The internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, cited by Trump supporters as evidence of the president's authority, is not an episode we should ever care to repeat. Two, we also know that such acts are and should remain subject to the scrutiny of the courts for reason and rationality. In this case, and this is Tim speaking, I think the executive order fails that test. There has been no demonstrable risk of terrorist agents entering the U.S. as refugees." He says, "I think this executive order is wrong because it demeans the office of president, demeans the work of the U.S. government, and demeans the American people by portraying us as racist and xenophobic cowards. Given all the anti-Islamic statements Trump made during his campaign, there can be little doubt this order has nothing to do with security and everything to do with politics." Would you agree with that characterization, Jeff Whittison?
That was a long characterization. So. I caught the majority of it, and it sounds like he's making the case for the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals case that is pending right now. The President of the United States has plenary power, immigration powers, and something that you have to consider is the U.S. Constitution only applies to people who are in the United States. We're talking about people who are outside the United States, and in many senses, the U.S. Constitution does not apply to them. And that's a question. And even people who arrive at the JFK airport and who are detained may not legally be in the United States at that time. That's something up for debate that obviously I would be on the other side that, yes, they are in the United States. But that is an argument that they do not have constitutional rights. They don't have a right to an attorney at the airport. We could freely discriminate against them based on religion if we wanted to, because there is no constitutional protections to them. So the interesting thing about this Ninth Circuit Court case that is pending right now is that the plaintiffs are states, Washington and Minnesota. So they do have constitutional protections. But the question I think there, one of the big questions, is a very dense topic called standing, and that's I listened to the oral arguments before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and largely that's what they were arguing about was standing, and I think that may be what it turns on.
And explain to us what that means.
Well, standing is basically, and I'm not a constitutional law expert. I did go to law school where they taught it, and I had to pass the bar exam. And every once in a while, it pops up in immigration law, and it certainly reared its head this time. But standing, you can think of it in a simple sense is the person who gets harmed. I can't file a lawsuit if someone else got harmed because I don't have, you know, that didn't happen to me.
You have to be able to demonstrate harm.
Right,
to you.
Exactly. And I won't go into the to the specifics of it because I'd probably skewer it. But I think that what Washington and Minnesota are saying is that the harm that they are suffering is to their public colleges and universities. Professors who had plans to possibly travel out of the country now have to cancel, and really the harm doesn't have to be a great big harm. When we're talking about monetary harm, it can be something small. For example, when President Obama tried to pass the Deferred Action program for parents of children who are U.S. citizens, 25 states filed lawsuits in Texas in a case called United States v. Texas, and they found that these states had standing because their injury was that each state had a $130 administrative cost to issue licenses to these people who would get deferred action. And that was enough to find standing. So I think that there is enough to find standing in this case. I'm sorry, I really deviated from the guy's the caller's characterization.
That's okay. So we've talked about historically since September 11th, we haven't really seen acts of terrorism on U.S. soil perpetrated by foreign nationals. And there is the exception, I think, of the Tsarnaev brothers, who were the Boston Marathon bombers, and David Chanzer, you mentioned those guys. They were not, anyway, from a country. I mean, that's sort of an outlier of a case. But this order has been denounced as a ban on Muslims. President Trump has said, he's vehemently denied that and said this is not about singling out a particular religion. But David Chanzer, if it's not that, why has it been so offensive to many people who are Muslim?
Well, there is one provision of it that is, you know, overtly discriminatory. And whether, as Jeff said, whether the courts can actually reach that issue or not is a separate issue. But on its face, this is a document coming out of our White House from our president that says that, you know, if you're a refugee coming from Syria and you're a Christian, well, then there'll be an exception to the ban. But if you're Muslim, you can't come. So on its face, it is religiously discriminatory against Muslims. And, of course, you can't divorce it from the rhetoric that we saw prior to the campaign or during the campaign. And, again, that might not be admissible evidence in a courtroom, and so who knows about the outcome of the validity of it. But in terms of its messaging, I think it couldn't be any more clear. Matter of fact, when the president was introducing it, he kept saying, "We don't want them here." And it was pretty clear what he meant by that. And again, to me, that's a terribly bad security strategy because we've got 1.2 billion Muslims in the world. We have many, many governments who are our allies, who are actually putting their troops out in the field to fight extremism and are losing thousands of soldiers, whether they be in Pakistan, Iraq, the Kurds, elsewhere. And so these are our allies in this fight. And to insult on a basis of religion, the people that we need to quench extremism and you know, degrade and destroy these groups that are causing so much violence, I think is just terribly bad security strategy. It's going to backfire on us.
David Chancer, is one's position on this executive order a partisan question? Is support or opposition to this falling predictably along party lines?
Well, that remains to be seen, because right now the battle is in the courts. Certainly some Republicans are being strong advocates of what the president has done. I think others are less comfortable and are not being as overtly supportive. And then, of course, there are a lot of Democrats who are being advocating against it. The support for refugee program in this country has been bipartisan. Who are refugees? It's basically usually women and children who are escaping the ravages of war. And so that's not a partisan issue at all. The question of religious discrimination, persecution on the basis of religion, that's not a partisan issue either. And I think many Republicans who are well-versed in this area are not at all comfortable with that aspect of it either. So we're going to have to see how this plays out once it's sorted out by the courts.
And we have a little more than a minute before we go to break, but Helen Terakich and Jeff Whittison, I want to hear from you two, since you're both immigration attorneys. How is this changing your practice and what you need to bone up on? What is this? How is it different, Helen, since this order was signed?
That's a great question. I guess I'll have to thank Jenny Doyle for sending me a pocket constitution as a gift last week, because I really have been rereading the Establishment Clause, which is about separating religion from our government. And I have spent a lot of time working on the concept of admissions for clients who are not just from these seven countries, but also from many others.
And we're going to hear more about that from you and from Jeff Whittison when we come back from the break. You're listening to Coastline. We're talking today about the recent executive order that blocks immigration and refugees from seven majority Muslim countries. When we come back from this 90-second break, you'll have one more segment to call in with your question or comment on this Thursday. You can reach us today at 910-343-1138 or by email at coastline@whqr.org. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today, we're learning about how the recent presidential executive order on immigration is impacting North Carolina and the Cape Fear region. Here to answer your questions on this Thursday are David Chancer, professor at Duke University and director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security, Jeff Whittison, attorney at McKinney Immigration Law, and Helen Terakich, manager and owner of Helen Terakich Law, PLLC, which specializes in immigration and naturalization cases. If you have a question or a comment about the order, you can call us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Helen, just before we went to break, you were explaining that you now have a pocket constitution. We were talking about how your practice and Jeff Whittison's practice is being forced to change and the new areas of expertise you're having to pick up. So what else is different for you about this?
Well, I think that the thing that has really created chaos within our immigration practice has been that there are a number of draft executive orders floating around there that may cancel any number of other programs that exist.
Draft executive orders.
Yes. So these are things saying, for example, they'll cancel the DACA program, which was for children who were here before the age of 16, who were given work permits and are here lawfully present.
What we think of as the Dreamers.
The Dreamers, exactly. So there's a draft order saying that they won't be able to use their travel permits anymore to come in and out of the United States, and also one that says that they will cancel the program but allow their work permits to expire. It doesn't say presumably so that Congress can finally pass a law to remedy the situation. It just says the permits would be expiring.
So this is a draft, though. This is something that you've seen floating around, but
right.
It's not been signed.
Right. And then there are other things that accompany the Muslim travel ban executive order, including internal enforcement executive orders, which are trying to have authorities deport people without a hearing if they don't have proof that they've physically been in the United States for at least 2 years. That's obviously terrifying. And then I do a lot of business immigration, and I have a number of multinational executive managers who live here in Wilmington and have opened companies that have a number of employees. And the president has announced that those paroles or travel permits for people like my multinational executives should be additionally scrutinized, and that the program should only allow people to travel for basically extreme reasons like a life or death situation. And there is nothing in that order that says that multinational managers, for example, who need to go to their home countries for business and who have valid travel permits will then be able to do so. So what we're seeing is a group of people who are constantly contacting our office about trying to come into the United States. And there's a whole other group of people who are afraid that if they leave, they won't be able to be readmitted. And now the question is, these travel bans and executive orders that are already in place or currently restrained or are floating out there as a draft are making it impossible for them to make real-world decisions, like, do I open another business or subsidiary of our business in the United States? Can I go home to have a meeting with my company abroad? May I use the travel permit in my hand that's valid right now in order to leave for 2 weeks on business, or do you think that something will happen that will stop me from coming back in?
So this could potentially have an economic impact on local economies.
I think it's already had an impact. I think that people are already I've had at least one of our executives cancel his travel plans to a country in Europe that is not on the list because he could not possibly risk missing all of the other things that are happening at his company if his travel is delayed to return. So he's actually got a valid L1A visa. He's been approved for an immigrant visa petition and is just basically waiting on his green card to be issued. And he's basically uncomfortable using a travel permit that's in his hand because there is an order from President Trump that states that the parole provisions of federal law shall be strictly enforced and not abused, and that additionally it goes on to say basically that only in extreme circumstances will people be allowed to return on those parole documents to the United States. And I know parole sounds like a weird word, so let me just take a second there. a travel permit can be issued, and it's called parole or advanced parole, and it really just means permission to be or to enter. And it's those permits that they're talking about restricting. And the decision to admit these people on those documents is made by very minimally trained immigration officers at the airport. And their decision to admit or not admit them is almost always something that's kind of unreviewable in the majority of circumstances.
What do you mean unreviewable?
So let's say that the manager comes into the United States and he's got his travel permit and they want more proof that he attended certain business meetings, but he doesn't. He's not. His phone is dead. He's not able to get in and give some more information about what happened at those meetings, or he doesn't have a letter showing that his grandmother was dying and that's why he was traveling. So the airport officers that we all see when we come in from outside of the United States, they take him into secondary inspection into a back room. They can handcuff him to a chair, detain him otherwise.
Is he entitled to counsel?
We're saying yes. Other people are saying no. And in general, attorneys are not allowed back there. It's only really been with some of this very awesome litigation that's going on right now where there have been a couple of circumstances where the attorneys are allowed to go back there. So if the officers don't like what they see, they basically put this person back on a plane to their home country without a hearing, and they're unable to see a judge. And then the practical part of that is that there's often so much pressure that goes on in that back room where you have no access to counsel or to even consult with other family members who might have been in line that, you know, they say, look, you can either withdraw your application for admission and we'll put you on a plane back to your home country right now, or we're going to really be mean and give you a 5-year deportation order and you'll be banned. And trying to get that revoked is almost impossible. So the consequences to not going with the flow with what that immigration officer wants are so extreme that there's this incredible duress upon the people who are trying to negotiate their entry into the United States. And they often make decisions under such stressful circumstances that they're decisions that really shouldn't have had to been made at that time.
We've talked about refugees and immigrants, and Jeff Whittison, you work with asylees.
Yes, that is correct.
What's the difference between a refugee and an asylee?
So a refugee is someone who – both of them are fearing persecution back in their home country. But a refugee is still in their home country, and they are generally – they apply with, I think, the – I honestly do not have a lot of experience with that refugee program simply because it's done out in the other country. But from what I understand is they apply with the United Nations first, and then they – are handed out to whatever country they find that will be able to take the refugee, and that there is a 21-step vetting program that they go through. The applications take anywhere from like 18 months to 24 months. It's a very long period. Asylees are here in the United States, and if they're not in deportation proceedings and they apply, it's called an affirmative filing. They have to do it within 1 year of being in the United States. If they're in deportation, they can file it directly with the immigration judge, and that's called a defensive filing.
And you also work with people who might have criminal backgrounds.
Oh, yes. That's largely how ICE will – ICE is the enforcement division for Department of Homeland Security. That is how they detect – detain people is because they've committed a crime. The local law enforcement will communicate with ICE saying that, you know, we have charged this person with this crime. We suspect that he may not be have a lawful status in the United States, and then immigration will come get him. So people who are in deportation, especially during the last 4 years with Obama, because he focused solely on criminals. So almost all my clients who are in deportation have a criminal background. However, Donald Trump, through another immigration executive order, has said that he's going after more than just people with criminal backgrounds. He's going to go after the low-hanging fruit that is anyone they find, including single mothers who have 5 U.S. citizen children, 2 of which are disabled, and she has no criminal background.
But she's here undocumented.
She's
You're talking about
undocumented.
Someone who is
yes.
here illegally.
Yes, yes.
And there are a lot of people listening who would say, if you came here illegally, you should have to leave. This is not an open border.
If there were
You have just, to go through the
yes.
protocol.
I've heard that time and time and time again. I've been an immigration attorney now 11 years, same as Helen. that is a song that has been repeated over and over to me. We don't have the resources to deport everyone all at the same time, and even if we did, we would be shooting ourselves in the foot.
Why?
They pick our crops. They do the jobs that Americans don't want to do. I'm not going to list everything. They and their businesses, if they have their own businesses, are paying taxes. They are paying taxes on not all of them, but a lot of them are. They are family members of U.S. citizens. They are parents of U.S. citizens. It would destroy the fabric, I think, of our country to do something that inhumane to gather everyone up and to deport them all at the same time.
Why do you think there's such an appetite for that now?
I just wanted to say one more thing.
Sure.
Our country doesn't have the money to do that. ICE came out or Department of Homeland Security came out a few years ago and said that the budget to deport one person on average can be $5,000. Multiply that by the 12 million undocumented people who is estimated to be in the United States, and tell us where we're going to get the money to do that.
So you're saying financially it's just not feasible. Let's
yes.
say it was. The fact that Trump is in the White House, as some could interpret as a very strong wave from the American people of wanting to see more secure borders. Less porous borders where people are coming in and using public services, taxpayer dollars that they're not entitled to. There is a sentiment that is saying, hey, we want some security. We want to know that things work the way we say they work. Mm-hmm. We want to be able to say what you see is what you get. What's so wrong with that?
I don't know anyone who doesn't want better border security. I think most immigration attorneys are okay with that. But I'm not. What I just finished talking about is not border security. These people live in the United States already, and Helen probably can tell her experience. But in my experience, in the last 3 years, it is very unlikely that someone gets through past our border without being detained. And it's very they have done a really good job in the last 3 years, and I think that it can even get better.
I would just say also that we do have a net immigration from Mexico, so actually we've got less people coming in than we have going out. And
how long has that been true?
I don't have an exact time frame on that, but this is in recent years now. I'm not just a lawyer. I'm a mother, and I want my kids to be safe, and I understand the rule of law. I became a lawyer because I love laws and rules and order and structure. So I deeply understand how people feel emotionally about this idea of somebody has come here undocumented. But what's going on with the current administration is that they're actually saying people who are here, who have permission to be here and who are currently being vetted, even though they may have entered illegally, these folks who are actually signed up and waiting in line, like we've asked them to go through an immigration process correctly, are now going to be the ones that we'll be removing, as opposed to putting our resources in some type of an order that might actually go about the people who really scare me, the people who are abusing children, the drug traffickers. We have over 11,000 people living in literal slavery in the United States. And if we don't focus our resources to the really bad guys, the ones that keep us mothers and lawyers up at night, then we'll never, ever be able to accomplish that feeling of emotional security that the folks who are saying we need legal immigrants only are really striving for.
David Chanzer, Duke University. One criticism of this executive order on immigration is that it seemed like it was signed overnight. It was a surprise to a lot of people. From a national security perspective, is this not exactly how Donald Trump described his style when he was on the campaign trail? And his explanation for that strategy was pretty direct. You announced that you're having discussions about doing something everybody knows, and they try to move before you're able to actually do it. So did we not need this kind of a shakeup?
I think the whole idea that, well, I'm going to do my foreign policy by surprise and be unpredictable— of course, if we're going to do a terrorist raid like we did a couple weeks ago in Yemen, you want a blanket of security and secrecy over that. You don't want to let the enemy know what you're doing in advance. But when it comes to things like international trade or how you're going to implement your treaty obligations or the rules and regulations for allowing people in and out of your country, our allies, we live in a globalized system. Our allies don't want unpredictability, and our law enforcement can't handle unpredictability. And you want expert advice and opinions so you don't make egregious errors. So the idea of shooting from your hip and doing things that are a secret and then letting the chips fall where they may, that's what ends you up in court. That's what leads to international protests. Not consulting with other countries, and kind of the chaos that we have seen. And I don't think that makes us stronger. That makes our allies less able to rely on us. And you have to understand that since World War II, we're talking 70 years now, we have been the bulwark of stability, the place that other countries looked for security, people, an ally they can count on. And when we do some things that are irrational, unpredictable, we actually erode our soft power, our ability to influence the course of the world. And I think that makes us much weaker.
And that's all the time we have. Very briefly, Helen, is Wilmington about to become a sanctuary city?
I've contacted the mayor and I'm waiting on response.
That's this edition of Coastline. David Chanzer, Helen Terekich, Jeff Wittison, thank you so much for joining us today. Special thanks also to Duke University for making their studios available to us. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Production assistant is Emily Fulbright. Caleb Covington engineered today's show. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org or get the podcast from iTunes. Tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock. And join us each week for Coastline Live, Wednesdays and Thursdays at noon. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.